Hello and welcome to the Snow Christensen and Martineau Counselor's Corner, a podcast dedicated to keeping you up to speed with the ever-changing legal landscape. This podcast is brought to you by Snow Christensen and Martineau, a full-service law firm located here in Salt Lake City that has been serving clients for over 125 years. Today we are going to hear from Heather White on ways to prevent what we've seen as new search and seizure civil rights claims being asserted by the plaintiff's bar. Heather is a shareholder at Snow Christensen and Martineau and chair of the firm's governmental law practice group. For over 20 years, Heather has been defending governmental entities and their officers against complaints asserting the deprivation of civil rights.
We wanted to educate law enforcement about some new claims that are being made by specific plaintiff's attorneys. We have had several cases that involve these type of claims and want to ensure that our officers are prepared to respond when they confront them. They involve an issue regarding searches and seizures where officers obtain a warrant to search a certain area, such as a house or a house with an outbuilding. And when they arrive, they find that a portion of the residence or the outbuilding has been converted to a separate residence that is occupied by someone other than the suspect who is identified in the search warrant. We are finding that officers are generally relying upon the warrant to allow them to continue the search as authorized by the warrant. However, there is a specific exception that applies that requires the officers to reassess the extent of the warrant as it relates to this separate residence. And it may require the officers to either obtain a separate search warrant for the separate residence or to not search the portion of the residence covered by the warrant at all, unless they obtain a separate search warrant for that area. The beginnings of this principle occurred in 1987 with the United States Supreme Court decision of Maryland versus Garrison. And in that case, officers had obtained a search warrant to search an apartment, a third floor apartment on Park Avenue. The warrant specified, quote, the premises known as 2036 Park Avenue, third floor apartment, end quote. Now, when the officers obtained the warrant, they believed there was only one apartment on the third floor. But the third floor was actually divided into two separate apartments, one which was occupied by the target of the search warrant and the other by the defendant in the Maryland versus Garrison case. When the officers executed the apartment, or the warrant on the apartment, they searched both, and they found drugs during the search of the apartment of the non-targeted individual, and that individual was charged with a crime. During his criminal proceedings, he moved to suppress the evidence, claiming that the search of his apartment violated his Fourth Amendment rights. The trial court denied the motion, and it concluded that the officers validly relied on the issuance of the warrant in searching both of the apartments on the third floor. The issue eventually made its way to the United States Supreme Court, which concluded that the officers validly searched both apartments, but it created an exception. Now, looking to the underpinnings of the decision, of the validity, it based its decision on the following, in which it stated, quote, after making a reasonable investigation, including a verification of information obtained from a reliable informant, an exterior examination of the three-story building at 2036 Park Avenue, and an inquiry of the utility company, The officer who obtained the warrant reasonably concluded that there was only one apartment on the third floor and it was occupied by, end quote, the target of the search warrant. So based on that information, the court ruled that the actual warrant was validly obtained and there was nothing that rendered it on its face invalid. It went on then to focus on the execution of the warrant and whether that was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And that, the court concluded, was a closer call. It ended up ruling that the entry was lawful pursuant to the warrant and the search was lawful, but created these new rules back in 1987 that sheer reliance on a warrant in searching an area may not be valid where an officer encounters what then appears to be a separate residence. And the court ruled that the warrant itself did not provide a safe harbor in these incidents. It determined the search in this case was reasonable because, quote, objective facts available to the officers at the time suggested no distinction between the non-target's apartment and the third floor premises, end quote. And the key points that really came out of this case were a couple of quotes from the case. One is, if the officers had known or should have known that the third floor contained two apartments before they entered the living quarters on the third floor, then they would have been aware of the error in the warrant and they would have been obligated to limit their search to the target apartment. So that's the first exception. And what that tells us that if they knew ahead of time that there might be a separate residence, that reliance on the warrant was not reasonable because there was an error of which they should have been aware. The second key point is that the officers were required to discontinue the search of the non-target apartment as soon as they discovered there were two separate units on the third floor, and that would have put them on notice of the risk that they might be in a unit erroneously included within the terms of the warrant. So that really began the rule that just sheer reliance on the warrant is not sufficient. We fast forward to 2006, and as we're looking at civil rights cases, there's the doctrine of qualified immunity, which has the clearly established prong as a method for which officers, even if they are found to have violated the Constitution, can still be found not liable if the law was not clearly established. But the Harmon versus Pollock case in 2006 clearly established within our circuit more specifics about this. And that is really the basis of where the plaintiffs in these new cases that we're seeing are relying for their claims. In the Harmon case, officers obtained a search warrant for a home located at 44 West 2700 South in Salt Lake City, Utah. And the warrant also authorized them to search a detached structure that resembled a garage on the premises. So when they executed the search warrant, searching the garage, and two individuals who resided at 44 and a half West 2700 South and who had no connection to the suspected drug activity were detained. And they filed a civil rights action against the officer who searched, the officer who procured the search warrant and then a separate officer who participated in executing it because the warrant was for 44 West, even though it included the garage area. The district court granted summary judgment to the officers, and the Tenth Circuit affirmed the lawfulness of the entry, but it sent the case back to the district court to determine whether the officers acted reasonably in detaining the plaintiffs once they entered the separate residence, And the basis for that was, were they reasonably on notice that this was a separate residence that was not connected to the suspects for which they obtained the warrant? Now, they focused again on three separate prongs. And the first was issuance of the warrant. The Tenth Circuit concluded, as did the Supreme Court back in Maryland versus Garrison, that the issuance of the warrant was valid. And it reasoned that the affidavit and the warrant provided an accurate physical description of the structure that was to be searched. And they had previously been surveilled not revealed anything from the outside that this was a separate residence as opposed to a garage that was attendant to the 44 West address for which the warrant applied. They concluded there was no evidence that the officer obtained the warrant knowingly and intentionally misstated or excluded material information regarding the detached structure in the affidavit in support of the warrant. So they found that the warrant itself was valid. But then they moved on to the execution of the warrant, which they held was a closer call. And that's where the two other prongs come. The first was entry, and the second was the actual search. And they said it was a much closer call on those two issues, but ruled that the entry was valid. And they engaged in a heavily fact-dependent analysis in reaching that conclusion. Facts they found were problematic and weighed against the officers were that there were two mailboxes on the front of the house, which could have indicated to the officers that there were two separate residents. The officers never saw any suspects go in or out of the garage apartment. Salt Lake County records indicated that in addition to the single family residence, there was an outbuilding consisting of a garage and a finished main floor. So that cut against the officers, they ruled. They also said that a deed of trust showed two addresses for the given property, which were 44 West, 2700 South, and 44 and a half West, 2700 South. 44 and a half West, 2700 South had a separate gas account. The United States Postal Service had the 44 and a half West, 2700 South address listed in its database. And the phone company sent bills to the 44 and a half West, 2700 South address. Also problematic for the officers, which the court ruled were indicative of a separate residence, were that the plat indicated two lots. The plaintiff's vehicles parked on the property were not those seen being used by the targets of the search warrant. The outbuilding had pipes from the roof, a door and a window that looked residential, as they termed it, and a light and a mailbox situated near the door. They also were concerned that members of the scout team had told the officer who obtained the warrant that they were concerned the officers knew the outbuilding might be used as a residence or something other than a garage because there were reports of lights and voices and people coming and going. Also, the operations order listed the residence as a single family dwelling with a detached garage residence and often referred to residence number one and residence number two. So that was problematic. But despite those negative facts, the court concluded that officers under the circumstances reasonably concluded that the garage was not a separate residence for several factors. They recognized that the officer who obtained the warrant thought one of the two mailboxes on the front of 44 West, 2700 South was for a newspaper. Additionally, there was no evidence that any of the officers noticed the pipes coming out of the back of the roof or thought the door and the window on 44 and a half West, 2700 South were signs of a residence. Now, that could be enough to create a fact dispute, but in this case, it did not. It probably relied on how the testimony went at the depositions, but that could very well go against an officer in another case. The court also found that the investigating officer checked the Salt Lake County Recorder's office records, which showed that 44 West 2700 South was a single family dwelling with one detached structure, which was a garage, so that it didn't have it as a separate apartment. And it also ruled that the officer was reasonable in not checking Questar records for the 44 and a half West address because it was not shown as a separate residence in the county recorder's or office or other records. When the officer reviewed the South Salt Lake City plans and records, it showed that the target was a single occupied residence with one address, and the garage was not a separate residence but part of the property. And there was no other objective indicia through surveillance that the garage was a separate residence. So the court ruled that the actual entry was valid, but then went on to examine whether the search, once they opened the doors and saw what was inside, was valid. And it concluded, based on the facts in the record, it could not make a determination, so it remanded it for an evidentiary hearing. The officers there testified that facts that led the court to conclude the officers reasonably believed the garage apartment was a crash pad used as a place to store and use drugs. And their observation of marijuana and a pipe in plain view further justified the detention and continued search. So the Tenth Circuit, based on that factual record created on remand, concluded that the actual search was legal and lawful, and that the officers reasonably believed the plaintiffs were connected to the illegal activity at the main residence until they completed all of the question. But it did open the door for possible fact disputes, and the problem that if an officer should reasonably see once he or she enters, even if the search warrant was valid, even though the entry was valid and the warrant was valid, that the search might still not be valid. And the key really points to this are that it is a very fact-specific determination. So officers need to include in their reports everything that establishes that it was associated or connected with the main residence that is the target, related to the target of the search warrant. And there must be really very little indicia or no indicia of a separate residence. And the officers need to ensure that they connect in as many ways as possible the what the plaintiffs are alleging is the separate residence to the main residence. So if officers enter premises and they can't tell from the outside, well, let's start if they get there and they see certain things that maybe call into question whether this might be a separate residence, whether or not it's legal. Officers need to stop. And it's most advisable, while they may reach the same result as in the Harmon case, the officers have opened themselves up to a lawsuit and all the discovery and the cost and expense and the headache that goes with that. Whereas if they encounter that from the outside, maybe they back off and call and get a separate warrant, or they don't execute, they wait to execute on the area, on the separate residence, or what appears may be a separate residence. If they do go ahead and enter, then officers really need to be aware of what does the inside of this area look like? Does it look like a separate residence? And that's a little more difficult when you're talking about, say, an apartment or a room that's being rented out within a house, as opposed to a separate detached dwelling. But it applies equally. And so officers need to use their common sense and experience and be very detailed in the reports to explain why they concluded it was attendant to the targets of the search warrant. So if officers do enter, say, for example, a separate structure or a basement that has a separate kitchenette area, it still may very well be part of the house. Many homes will have kitchenettes in the bottom, but if those are rented by a separate person, then it can become problematic. So things to look for are, you know, separate kitchenette areas. Is there just a fridge and a microwave where people might go, say, for example, on a crash pad and a TV to use drugs and to relax wait until the effects of the drugs wear off? You know, that's more like a crash pad, whereas something where you see maybe a dishwasher, a larger refrigerator, a sink, those may be more indicative of a separate residence. Additionally, a bathroom. And is that bathroom, is it, you know, walled off into a separate area? Is it just a toilet and a sink? Or is there a shower and a bathtub? Those are things really to be looking for. How organized the area is. Are there photographs or knickknacks hanging on the wall that would help sort of identify the place as a separate residence as opposed to just a crash pad? Closets could be indicative of a separate residence as opposed to merely clothes hangers. But again, if clothes hangers are present and it appears a wardrobe, you know, is there and it doesn't look like it's just a storage area, those are things that call into question and will be used to create at least a factual dispute over whether it was a separate residence and the officers were allowed to search the place. So we wanted to bring this to your attention to ensure two things. Number one, that you're aware of this and are looking at this after the area, of course, is, if there's no indicia from the outside, cleared and safe. You know, determining whether you can search it or detain people who are found in the area. And number two, so that our jurisdictions are providing training to their officers so that when they encounter these situations, it will not be a surprise to them, but they will be prepared and know what to do. I hope this information was helpful. If you have any questions about it, I'm certainly happy to answer them. You're welcome to call me on my direct line at my office or email me. And those are on our Snow Christensen and Martineau website. I'm happy to discuss situations and or provide training for officers in terms of what to do when they encounter those situations. And I just want to reiterate how grateful we are for all of the hard work and dedication that our officers and support staff and municipalities and counties provide to the public. And know that we're thinking of you and are looking for ways to help prevent you from having to get involved in these civil rights actions as opposed to just defending you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for coming to the Snow Christensen Martineau Counselor's Corner. Please join us next time.